your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Predictions vary as to the percent of jobs that are going to be lost to automation, to offshoring, and gigging. But it's likely to be between 20 and 60% roughly within the next decade or two. The consensus is that much of the remaining decent paying employment is going to demand ever more brain power, technical chops, and communication skills. And with so many applicants available, employers are going to be able to insist also on people who are likable, reliable, enthusiastic, healthy. The big question? What's going to happen to the many millions of people who don't get hired for those jobs? I fear that these things are going to be probably different from previous technological waves in which new technologies, net, created more new jobs. It may well be that there will be a net job loss this time because so much of the future economy is going to be based on digital products and services, which can be produced by the millions with a push of a button. I'm going to try to describe what I think is likely a problemed existence for those millions of people, and I'll then turn, I never like to describe a problem which I don't propose solutions, and then I'm going to propose some possible approaches to the amelioration. But lest I just lecture at you, and lest it just be my opinion, I have my frequent co-conspirator here on the line to ask questions, make comments, whatever, amplify, present a dissenting view, and that is my wife and the superintendent of schools of Napa County, the very smoky Napa County, as well as here in San Francisco, Dr. Barbara Nemko. Thanks for joining me.
You're welcome.
So I'm going to start, and then feel free to interrupt me at any point with a question, comment, or ameliorate, augmentation, whatever, okay?
I have felt free to interrupt you for the last 42 years, so why would I stop now?
Precise. Just a reminder to those listeners who may not be familiar and might think you rude for doing so, I encourage it, lest this be just seen as me pontificating. All right, I talked about these millions of people who likely are not going to have the brain power, technical chops, communication skills, likability, reliability, enthusiasm, whatever, to be hired in a world of so much automation and offshoring and part-timing and temping. A lot of them are going to flit from gig to gig that don't pay very well. Or they may have a stable job, but only because it pays poorly, and it's work that most people don't find intrinsically rewarding, like janitorial or low-level construction or landscape maintenance.
Excuse me.
Okay.
I think that those of us who were prepared from a young age to go into white-collar work tend to have a kind of elitist attitude about the sort of jobs that you just named. At the county office, we have lots of people employed in lots of different jobs. And we have a big team in general services, which includes maintenance, janitorial, et cetera. And the people that I see who are doing those jobs are not unhappy. And I think that's true for construction, low-level or not, landscape maintenance. There is something very rewarding about knowing that you are going to get to work and find it in X condition, and by the time you finish your manipulations, whatever you do, whether it's cleaning, planting, pulling weeds, it's going to look much better. And you get to work in places like our office, any company, with lots of people, so you're not isolated all day. You're not sitting somewhere alone with a computer for company, but you actually see people who stop and talk to you. And sometimes you get to work outdoors and sometimes indoors. So it's varied. And at the end of the day, you get to go home and you don't have to think about it anymore. It's not, oh my God, tomorrow I have six reports and the boss is going to this. It's predictable. It doesn't necessarily have a whole lot of seasonal changes, and you feel like you're doing a good job. And people tell you that, hey, looks great. So I'm not sure that this notion that they're going to be so unhappy and hate their jobs is true.
I think you make a legitimate point. And when I really think candidly about the jobs that I've had in my life, from a pure pleasure standpoint, the job I enjoyed the most was when I was a taxi cab driver in New York City.
Thank you.
Because I succeeded with nearly every client. Mm-hmm. They were surprised that I did a good job, and that I was quite fairly verbal, and I drove fast, and I have a good sense of direction, something that I do well. And, you know, as I, you know, during my work at home, and I take, in the middle of my day, I take breaks to take hikes with my dog. And during some of those hikes, I'm walking through residential neighborhoods, and I see construction people who are roofers, who are landscapers, etc. And they seem more relaxed in general than a lot of my very high-powered professional people who have less concrete outcomes. It's very difficult often to see the results of your labors. If you're, you know, if you're a manager or a leader or even a scientist, it may be a long time till you see concrete results, let alone if you're in a soft field like human resources where everything is so subjective. Now, I think it's a little too strong to say that those people are happier, but I think you raise an excellent point that even if more of the jobs are these low-status jobs that might that elitists might snub their nose at, that is an argument for maybe the future of fewer, quote, good jobs may not be such a bad thing. So
I couldn't agree more.
That's a good
point. I think about the people when I go to get my hair cut. Everybody who works in the salon mm-hmm. looks happy.
You're right.
And the people come in and they go out with a big smile on their face because they like what the person has done for them.
Absolutely. And that's not even true. You know, you may go to a high-end mm-hmm. salon. I just go to Supercuts. And, you know, it's your basic haircut and it's a production machine there. But everybody does seem to be happy. I'm not disagreeing with you.
And I don't go to a super salon. I go to a low price.
Okay, all right.
It's just not a chain, but it's similar to that.
Okay.
And people are happy. The women who work in the school cafeteria, who get to see kids these days choosing healthy foods that they've prepared for them, they're happy. They like seeing kids getting good nutrition. So I think lots of these jobs are really, really nice, and as the market tends to correct, so when they could get lots of people to do those jobs, they paid a little bit. But if that changes, then they can't find people to do it, then they'll pay more.
Well, let's see if, you know, that's what I doubt. If there's going to be all these people who are not going to be employable because there's going to be relatively few jobs because of all the automation of so much, and not just low-level work, but, you know, higher-level work, so much accounting work, law work, medical work is being done in an automated way. So you can have these large numbers of people competing for these, quote, low-level jobs, rewarding though they may be, and it's hard for me to picture that resulting in sustainable income. You know, I'm going to invoke my daily hike again. I was taking a hike with the dog, and I saw a passenger van with a sign that said, quote, volunteer drivers wanted. Who would think that a little van driver or bus driver would be volunteer position? I think about how much volunteer work many people I know do, and frankly, including me. I worry that because there'll be all these formerly middle-income people vying for even this lower level, if potentially rewarding work, that it's not going to be sustainable. And it could be, you know, because people want to stay busy, there'll be a lot of people willing to work for nothing. And I worried it might be a race to the bottom. Any reaction to that before I go on?
I think that people who volunteer are very unlikely to volunteer as a janitor. They're not going to volunteer as a hair cutter. They're not going to volunteer as a construction worker.
I'm talking
worker.
About 5 or 10 years from now when there'll be ever more. Right now we're at historic lows in unemployment. And I think that's largely because of, you know, government stimulus. And I'm not going to attribute it to either any administration or whatever. But I'm, you know, there is consensus that there is the mega vectors of automation, offshoring, temping, is likely to reduce the number of jobs. And therefore people who want to stay busy will work for either very little or for nothing just to stay busy, I believe. I want to move on from that. I think we've covered that one. So that's the negative, notwithstanding, as you correctly point out, these jobs may not feel as intrinsically unrewarding as I implied. But because there'll be, I believe, a large number of people not earning good income, that will probably give rise to a guaranteed basic income. They sometimes call it universal basic income. Maybe guaranteed health care, college, even food and shelter paid for by what will be a shrinking tax base. But it's possible, at least, that that may not be enough to maintain a functional society. I mean, if that amount of the guaranteed basic income, health care, college, food, and shelter is generous enough to please the recipients, it's going to really hit the middle class, which ends up paying most of the taxes, even if we tax successful corporations and the one percenters at 90%. So I'm envisioning maybe 100 plus million Americans and billions worldwide who are going to spend a lot of their time doing or looking for even modest jobs. Because if they're temp gigs, you may do the job. Unless you're a star, you'll do your job for 2 or 3 months. And then because it's a gig and they don't want to give you full-time benefits and all the rest of it, you're going to spend another month or two looking for work. And I think that that's for you're right. I stand corrected that some of that will feel okay and rewarding. But I think there'll be an increased number of people who would have formerly been in the middle class and at least feeling better about that and maybe being able to afford more, not that money buys happiness, but a certain amount does, some of those, the peaceable among them, will more likely escape with things like drugs. Like, I think it's possible that marijuana legalization may only be the first step. If there is going to be ever more under, let's call it underemployment, there will probably be pressure to legalize other drugs like so-called magic mushrooms or LSD or ecstasy. And because drug abuse reduces inhibition and it does increase mental illness, drug abuse, that in turn is going to likely increase crime, increase traffic accidents and the mayhem, pain and suffering that causes. And it's going to tax, I mean, our healthcare system is already, we see again and again, it's overburdened. 350,000 medical errors cause excess deaths every year in American hospitals. And then there are more violent people, both those who are intrinsically inclined to violence, as well as people who view violence as an appropriate way to get more what they call redistributive social justice, could, as in, say, Zimbabwe, violently appropriate homes, land, personal property from the society's haves that haven't sufficiently barricaded themselves behind these heavily gated and armed houses.
Oh, my God, the apocalypse is coming in your worldview.
Well, now I want to talk about solutions. And I really am eager. The first one I'm going to mention is one that I particularly want you to either push back or grudgingly agree, because you have spent your life in education. You are the superintendent of school. You are nationally prominent. You won a lot of education awards, all that stuff. So you have a PhD from Berkeley in education, as I do. But you're in a particularly good position to comment fair-mindedly about what I'm going to say about the most often proposed solution for all of this. The most often proposed solution is better education. I am no more than agnostic on this. I mean, my PhD specialized in evaluation of education, so I have monitored education's promise for decades. And in my judgment, my review of the literature, further improvement in education at a scalable level, not some little pilot program, but something that's scalable to the nation, may well yield only modest improvement in students' ability to do those well-paying jobs that are brain power intensive and technology centric intensive. Your reaction, do you agree, disagree, partially agree? What do you think, Barbara?
I think we're not going to necessarily train most of our people to do these very high level brain power engineering, engineering, lawyer, judge jobs. But I do think that schools do react to what's going on in society. And one of the reactions that is occurring right now is the, at long last, realization that the jobs that we so turned our noses up for such a very long period of time are where people can be employed today, and we are seeing more and more high schools developing programs in hands-on basic trades areas. So there, we are teaching advanced manufacturing, and we are teaching biotechnology. So they may not become the professor of biotechnology, but there will be lots and lots of jobs in biotech labs. We are teaching basic robotics, and we're teaching air conditioner and heating repair, and electrical and plumbing and construction. So we see that right now, if you have that kind of a skill in a job that cannot be offshored, you will do better. and then students can start in the high school, transfer to a community college, and get out and enter an apprenticeship and end up getting high-paying jobs.
Fair enough. And by the way, just came across my desk yesterday. There is a new website. Let me look it up. I think it's called apprenticeship.org. Let me look it up. I wasn't planning to mention it, but I've got it here somewhere. Yes, apprenticeship.gov, which is really cool because you can enter any keyword you want for some kind of a trade, like technician, robotic, or solar, or whatever, and your zip code, and how many miles from where you live you want to serve, and it will search the nation's all of the apprenticeship programs, or at least very thousands and thousands of them. So it's an easy way for people to get find out about an apprenticeship if you are more inclined to be working with your hands than not just purely intellectually. That might be a really good option.
Those are fabulous. And if you want to move up the career ladder, you can go to higher education paid for by the group that you're apprenticing with.
Okay.
They're very generous.
I want to talk to another common recommendation about how to address this potential problem of, you know, automation, offshoring, and temping, reducing the number of good-paying jobs, well-paying jobs, is it's often recommended to have, from kindergarten all the way through college, to have more emphasis on creating ethical entrepreneurs. And the argument goes that because only entrepreneurs create jobs without eating the country's seed corn, that is tax money. But I am not convinced, and this is the liberal side of me, I am not convinced that a more consumerist society, which is what entrepreneurship, they come up with new products, new services, new things for us to buy, I am not convinced that a more consumerist society is going to end up net better. Yeah, we benefit from iPhones, we benefit from big screen TVs, we benefit from GPS, although that was partly funded by the government, and we benefit certainly from easy buying on Amazon. But especially with fewer people likely able to afford more than the basics, it may, in my judgment, be wise to place our education bets on teaching people to care less about materialism and more about living simply, and this is sounding kumbaya-ish, be living simply, kindly, and valuing creative expression like music, art, writing, and I don't mean to dismiss sports or video or whatever. And I hope, and I'm cautiously optimistic that it'll work, because deep down, I think most people realize you cannot buy your way to contentment. But I can't confidently predict that, because there is a tendency toward survival of the fittest. So all this nice kumbayana stuff, there may be this intrinsic Darwinian desire to take care of number one, which may be more powerful than all the kumbaya lessons. I don't know. Any reaction on the wisdom of trying to address potential underemployment by creating more entrepreneurs, ethical ones, of course? Barb?
I don't know that it's school's job to teach people all about why they must love to live simply. I think there's a role for families in that, and how we deal with the difficulty if you can't find a job and you're not making a lot of money. We do teach entrepreneurship for those who want to be entrepreneurs, but I don't think that we can. Being an entrepreneur is a very complex job. And that takes an awful lot of knowledge in a large number of areas, and the ability to make good decisions and hire well and all kinds of things.
Moxie, a certain moxie. It seems like, you know, there are some people who have a greater predisposition to entrepreneurialism than others. But where I have to push back, and I don't agree with you, I do think it is maybe the most foundational role of the schools to teach values in one form or another. And I do think teaching people to value the non-pecuniary, the non-materialistic, is absolutely core to what schools should do. Hell of a lot more important than teaching geometry or French 3, in my judgment.
Once we get into teaching, I think we teach certain values. We teach kindness. We teach self-respect. We teach the ability to be responsible and caring. but I don't think we tell families how we think they should live, and we don't tell children.
I don't agree with you. Let's move on. We've argued about that. No, I think teaching people to live more simply, lightly on the earth, as the Quakers would say, I think is a clear good thing, and in the role of the schools, especially in a society that's been heretofore dominated by excess materialism. Now I want to offer one more suggestion. Which may never be feasible as a way of dealing with this, you know, it deals with income inequality, it deals with the lack of underemployment, we've been talking about that too few people may be able to do these very demanding jobs or create these demanding technical, brain power-centric jobs. This idea may never be feasible, or it may be deemed unethical, and that would be to increase the funding to understand the biological basis of intelligence and of altruism. That could lead to genome surgeons. They're already excellent at, for example, UCSF. They have genome surgeons who are doing gene editing using this technique called CRISPR. Anyway, that could lead to genome surgeons replacing, and this is probably 10 to 30 years from now, I'm not sure, this is a long-range project, replacing the gene cluster for low intelligence with one for high intelligence, and the cluster for malevolence, and even the cluster for indifference with the gene cluster for altruism. And I think that could be ethical as long as, first, certainly sufficient research was done in computer models and animal models to very carefully identify the side effect profile of that gene editing, and that profile is benign enough compared with the benefits of that genome editing. Also, before legalizing, let's just call it genetic augmentation or whatever, to ensure that such surgery would be covered under what the healthcare system for the poor that would be then extant, so it didn't exacerbate income inequality. And finally, to avoid having anything at all to be associated with the horrible Nazi eugenics that participate. There were all kinds of mechanisms in place to ensure that participation in that is purely voluntary. What's your reaction to that idea?
I think we're using all of this newfound information about our biology in very good ways. And certainly, if we can enhance people's ability to think and to do more complex work, that will better likely ensure them good jobs and good participation in society, that'd be a great thing.
Indeed. You know, of course, but it is rife. Once you're toying with the genome, you have great risks. But we do know that in the prisons, for example, the average cognitive functioning of the average prisoner is quite low. And part of that is because of their frustration in being able to make it in the, quote, straight world. But, you know, this is an idea on which I'm agnostic, but I think it's important on radio, especially public radio, to present just not the obviously suggested solutions, but more controversial ones to be agreed with, disagreed with, or just mused upon. We're a long way away from this happening. This is a little bit of blue skying. In the next segment of this show, we're going to be talking very down and, you know, practical about what you can do to improve your work life. But as regular listeners to the show know, I like to focus both on the big picture, societal issues, as well as local. I need to make one apologia here. Of course, these kind of long-term predictions may be dead wrong. I mean, remember the study that found that monkeys predicted stock market prices as well as did the CNBC pundits?
That's pretty funny.
I know. And it's like throwing a dart was as valid as these big experts on CNBC. And I remember a few decades ago, the experts said we'd be driving around in flying cars. Meanwhile, we're all in our Toyotas or whatever. We're even, for God's sake, pushing our Hoovers around. We're not even using a Roomba. You know, those automated, the robotic vacuum cleaners.
I think they were really cool.
Reviews are mixed. They're very mixed and expensive.
But I think you're forgetting. When you talk about messing around with people's genes, there is a whole world of religion out there that you don't think about that I think would be very against that.
Good point. Anyway, so there are my predictions and possible remediations as modulated by Barbara's comments. Now, my dear listeners, I want to let you know you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. What we're talking about is projecting out 10 to 30 years from now, what is going to happen to normal people who are not the tech super geniuses who are going to be the gurus developing the next artificial intelligence, deep learning, machine learning stuff, or biotech solutions to diseases, normal people. And we laid out what I thought was a likely scenario, as well as some possible approaches to amelioration. But I invite you to call now. So if you have a comment or a question about what we have projected as a possible likely scenario moving forward, as well as possible solutions, I invite you to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Somebody wrote me a note writing this. Instead of genetic surgery, what about, quote, positive psychology? An emerging science, not emerging, it's been around for 20 years, that investigates the qualities, attitudes, and practices that enable people to thrive and be happy. This is the topic on Philosophy Talk this Sunday. There's no question that environmental influences matter. It has long been agreed that we are all a product, both of our genes and environment. And I think it's a fair point to say that whether it be positive psychology or any kind of programs to enhance people's self-efficacy is certainly worth adding to the equation. So I thank, and this came from Joanne Marr, our engineer, who, as usual, listens very carefully. Appreciate it very much. So I'll give it the phone number again. Either if you want to make a question or a comment regarding this vision for what will likely happen to normal people and possible ways to ameliorate it, we invite you to call here at KALW and work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko, or, as usual, and now as we enter the second half of this show, and we are eager to help you with your work-life problem. This now does not need to be lofty and societal. It can be about you. If you are unhappy in your work life, no matter what your, pardon the pun, station in life, whether you're 16 or 76, for-profit or non-profit, employed or unemployed, a clerk or a CEO, the common denominator issue is if you are unhappy and have a work-life problem that you would like Barbara and I to take a shot at, we invite you to call. For what we call a workover, no pummeling involved, usually the phone number, either because you want to comment about our projections for what will happen to normal people in the likely future of automation, offshoring, and temping, or you've got a work-life problem that you would like to our attempt to try to help you out with, the phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while we're waiting for the calls to come in, I want to turn, as I said, to the down and dirty practical. You know, it is often, I've said this to people, and they say, what? I say this, that love has a hell of a lot to do with finding a job, especially if you're a career changer. And here's why. Often it's irrational for an employer to hire a career changer. I mean, why hire somebody with no experience when by simply placing an online ad on Indeed.com or LinkedIn or whatever, that employer can usually, for a similar salary, find a person with good experience. So what I want to talk about, and Barbara, I want to get your reactions, is how can a career changer make the employer do the irrational? That is, to make that employer fall in love with you. I'm not talking about romantic love, although that's been known to work occasionally. I'm going to share what I want to, what, you know, some other ideas to get person, the employer, to fall in love with you. But I'd rather prioritize my dear listener. So we'll do that when we finish with a caller or two. I'll give out the phone number again. If you have a work-related problem, the phone number, 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello?
I'm interested in, I thought it was very interesting what you talked about with these jobs kind of disappearing, some of the lower wage, normal people jobs.
Even higher wage jobs. Lots of what you're talking about, even lawyer and accountant and surgeon jobs and doctor jobs are, you know, some of which are really unfortunately going to be going by the wayside. It's amazing what deep learning has enabled computers to do. Please continue, though.
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly right. So I'm a black man. I live here in San Francisco. I work in technology. But I think that I'm a little alarmed currently because there are so few people of color who work in the sectors of the high-paying jobs, particularly here in California and in Silicon Valley. And I get very worried when I think about the year 2040, which is apparently the year that minority becomes majority in the United States, and the fact that I would say the majority of people of color do not work in the upper paying high tech jobs. It's mm-hmm. very low. Mm-hmm. So I would love to kind of know what is happening in that space, or what your thoughts are, or your guest thoughts are on transitioning people from who are already at the sort of bottom of the pay rate into some of those jobs and opportunities, what the future looks like for them, for us.
I am optimistic. I have mm-hmm. heard again and again of initiatives both within the colleges, community colleges, four-year colleges, within industry, to close what's called the digital divide, and it's happening also K-12. And it's been described, this is the year of the woman. I also, from at least through my eyes, as I am viewing the world of work, et cetera, I'm seeing a tremendous amount of focus on increasing the number of people of color in these spaces. So I think long before 2040, there will be more people. I always like to say it's not just a matter of bringing color to the workplace. It's getting, making sure that it's not just to fill a number, but that they really are qualified, so they're set up for success. But I am very optimistic that there will be more. If I had to bet, I would take $10,000 out of my savings account, and I would bet that by 2025, there will be a far larger percentage of the workforce in Silicon Valley being people of color, not just Asian, but including African Americans and Latinos. Barbara, I'm going to thank you for the call. Barbara Nemko, do you have anything you want to add?
I think that's a no-brainer. Of course there will. I think that's the entire focus right now in Silicon Valley for those high-paying jobs.
Entire is way too strong, but it's certainly clearly an increased focus without any question. I think that's is that a little bit more fairer and more nuanced way to describe it?
Well, I'm not so nuanced.
All right. I'll give out the phone number again. If you've got a work-related problem and you would like me to help you with it, maybe you're still, you could be 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 and still not sure what you want to be when you grow up, or you are well ensconced in your employment or self-employment and you have a question or that you'd like to raise, that about a question about your work life that you'd like Barbara and my help with, or I love stories. If you've got a work-life story that might be instructive to our dear listeners, that's another good reason to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty and Barbara on KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before we went to the phones, we were talking about the seemingly absurd notion that love has a lot to do with finding a job. And I made the assertion that because, especially for career changes, it's irrational for an employer to want to hire somebody with no experience when with relatively little effort they can place a low-cost ad and find somebody with experience. And so I'm about to outline some ways in which you can get an employer to fall in love with you. And Barbara, I want you to be as tough as you can on me, as long as you're being fair, as to why you think either this wouldn't work, or ask me questions, because this has worked for many of my clients. But I want, it's so second nature to me to make these assertions, and for a listener and somebody else, you're no career counselor, you're a superintendent of schools. It may not be so obvious to you. So questions or criticisms are most welcome.
Well, let's start with, you need to define your definition of, quote, falling in love with you, because that has a certain connotation for most of us.
Well, as I said, I wasn't
read the article. That's not the connotation that you're giving.
Clearly, well, I said that I was not talking about romantic love, although that's been known to work. What I'm talking about is to get an irrationally kind, fond feeling for you enough that they're willing to say, the hell with it. I'm not going to apply. I'm not going to go and interview, have a review 100 resumes and interview 7 candidates and put them through 5 rounds of the interviews and then check on their references in great detail. I really like this person. So, maybe I'll interview a couple of people, but I kind of like this person. I want to hire them. That's the kind of love I'm talking about.
True.
Okay.
And, that helps. But I think the techniques that you're going to talk about are really just generally good interpersonal skills that everybody needs to learn how to manifest.
Well, to some extent, but you're putting a pin in my whole balloon here before
so
I even
sorry.
Started.
Would I do that to you?
Yes.
Yes, I would.
Okay, so it is faster to get an employer to fall in love with you if they already start out by liking you, obviously. And of course, the odds of that occurring, taking somebody who likes you and turning into somebody who loves you, is very small. So you've got to make a list of everyone who likes you, even if you know they can't hire you for an on-target job for you. People know people. So if you can get them to, quote, fall in love with the idea of your getting your target job, they can make an enthusiastic introduction which levitates your stature compared to other applicants who are merely sending in an application cold. And of course, employers know, unfortunately, that there's a lot of, let's just say, creative writing in applications. But if you are touted enthusiastically by somebody, all of a sudden you are far more credible and more likely to get the job. Now, that's a component of getting somebody to fall, you know, that's the first thing, to continue the seduction. For each of those people on your list who you're hoping to, if not hire you, refer you, you've got to decide the right way to approach them. There's a tendency, some of my clients, when they first come in, oh yeah, I emailed a bunch of my friends. Not good. This is an emotional thing. And so you've got to decide for each person what feels like the right way to approach them to making your ask. Should you just email them? Should you phone them? Should you just happen to run into them? Should you invite them to a party? Should you invite them out for a drink? Or to vape yourself into oblivion? Or to have dinner together? Or to go for a hike? Or a ball game, which allows a lot of time for conversation? There's a heck of a lot in a football game. There's a lot of wasted time, or a basketball game. There's a lot of time in between the game for chatting.
For sure.
Right. And then, when you're at that getting together, there's a tendency to ask too quickly. Like, say, hi, how are you? You might wonder why I'm calling. I'm looking for a job. You can't make the ask prematurely, any more than you would prematurely ask a potential romantic partner to have sex. And this is very important. And this is not so much about love, but I can't go further without mentioning this. So many of my clients, when I've asked them how they go about making the ask, they're either too vague or they're too specific. If it's too specific, you know, it's too unlikely that the person they're asking is going to have a lead for them. If you say, for example, I'm looking for a job counseling postmenopausal mixed-race women with an eating disorder.
But you I don't know anyone with that job.
Exactly. But you can't make the ask too broad, like, I'm open to anything, because that makes you appear desperate. So I want to give you an example of a sweet spot ask. It's like something like, I was in biotech consumables. I was a salesperson, and I did well, but it's feeling kind of empty. So I'd like to use my sales and my science skills as a fundraiser for a medical-related nonprofit. Might you know someone I should speak with? That's the sweet spot between I'm open to anything and excess specificity.
That was beautiful.
Thank you. Let's see if you can find something, but please keep listening for opportunity to amplify, disagree, or ask a question. So, but as usually what the problem is, I don't want to be simplistic here, usually the person's going to say that he or she doesn't have a lead for you. What's key is how you respond, because it's very unlikely that at that moment that person's going to have a lead for you. But the key is to say something like this. You say, I understand. Would you mind keeping your ears open and letting me know if you hear of anything? And if I'm still looking in a month, would you mind if I circle back with you? Now that they're going to likely say yes to, and thus you've recruited a scout. Well, because I said the odds of one person at that moment having a lead for you is small, the odds are that one of, say, if you've contacted 20 people, the odds of one or more of those 20 scouts having a lead for you, say, within a month, are much better. Now I want to continue with the love analogy thing. The love analogy maybe is at its strongest in the job interview. These days, a lot of the first interviews are on the phone or a webcam, or it could be a live interview. It's critical that in a webcam, or even on the phone, in a webcam, you look them in the eye. Yes, you got to think of the webcam lens as an eye. I mean, TV anchors are often told to make love to the lens. That builds intimacy with the viewers. And if it's a phone interview, they often tell you to smile around you, the phone, because that comes through in your voice. That's all part of the seduction. It's part of love. And in the in-person interview, or even if it's not in-person, but if it's a group interview, whether it's on a webcam or it's live, part of the seduction is to make sure you are looking the questioner in the eye as he or she is asking the question. And then as you start to answer, look into the eyes of the panelist to the far left. And after a second, continue your answer as you then turn your eyes to the person adjacent. After another second or two, turn your eyes to the person next to him or her, and so on. Eye contact encourages love. Not, again, we're not talking romantic love, but the kind of emotional connection that makes somebody say, you know, I just kind of feel like I really like this person. I feel connected. Another way to do that is with storytelling. I've said this before on the radio, but it's important for me to reiterate in this context. We all are moved emotionally by story. That's part of the falling in love. Tell what I call our PAR stories. It's an acronym in which you tell how you solved a problem that would impress your target employer. PAR stands for that problem, the clever or dogged approach that you took, and the positive result. And then your seduction's climax is after the interview in the way in which you write the thank you letter. If it's true, say that you've now loved the employer. Ideally, both your would-be supervisor and your place of employment. For example, you might write something like, I felt that you and I would be a good match based on the job description, but having met you and learned more about the company, I'd really love to work with you because, and then you cite something that you loved or at least liked about the boss or the company. So, you know, of course, all analogies don't perfectly apply. But Barbara, can you see why job seekers, especially career changers, are often wise to try to get employers to fall in love with them?
Yeah, I just wouldn't describe it as falling in love. But yes, everything that you said is something that everyone needs to know in order to be successful. Whether you go for a job interview or you're on the job, you need to learn how to look people in the eye. You want to be careful in while you're speaking during the interview. Don't stare too long into anybody's eyes. They'll think there's something weird about you.
That's a fair point. All right, we've got calls on the line. I want to give out the number again. If you have a work-related problem, we're here to try to help you. This is our pro bono work. We do it because we care. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko for what we call a workover. Any kind of work problem, we'll try to help you solve it. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And to the phones. It's your turn on the air. How can we help? Hi.
Hello, is that me?
It is.
Oh, yay.
Hey.
Hello, I love your show.
Thank you.
So I've just mustered up the courage to call this time.
Awesome.
I'm 53 years old, and I'm going to be forced to be a career changer due to an injury. So I also went to UC Berkeley. I did political economy and a minor in Spanish literature.
People love that major, the political economy major at Berkeley. I've heard so many people say they like it. Did you like it?
I did. I loved it because it was integrating political science and economics. I mean, they go hand in hand.
Yep.
So it was, I really enjoyed doing that. So I ended up working, though, because I'm fluent in Spanish, working with organizations and nonprofits that helped immigrants and refugees. And I spent my entire adult life working in that space, helping immigrants integrate into society here, learning the different rules, and then making services more accessible. And I worked in another state, in Vermont. I worked for 10 years there. Mm. Returning to California, I suffered a head concussion. And that threw me out for 4 years. In a fog for 3 years. And it's, you know, only because I had support, family, and support have I been able to be okay. If I didn't, I would be on the street.
Breathtaking.
And it just, you know, breaks my heart because I think half the homeless people must have head injuries because you are just lost. And if I didn't have family to help pay rent, to help pay for things, I couldn't even figure out, I need to apply for disability. Mm-hmm. And I needed help to do all of these things.
It breaks my heart just to listen to you.
Yeah, no, it's just, it's horrible. Coming back to California, you know, my idea was to work with unaccompanied children, and then this whole thing, you know, families being separated, it's like that would have been a space where I would totally be jumping into, but I am very limited in, you know, I can't take any leadership roles anymore because I used to be a very big leader and advocate in the space, but I have to figure out what can I retrain myself in, what can I do, and how can I make a, who's going to want to love me, to hire me and take a chance on me.
Okay.
Because I'm pretty much starting over, starting at zero at 53.
Well, let's see if we can avoid having to start from zero.
Wait, before you do that, I want to tell her I'm in love with her and I'd hire her.
Right, she sounds great.
It's a compelling story.
And you don't sound foggy. You sound very coherent. You're very concise.
Well, yeah, I'm coming out of the fog, and I'm just wired. I was a type A person. I was just like, give me the thorniest, ugliest problem, and I was the one to resolve those. I was the connect the dot person. I resolved macro level problems, but I'm very afraid to take on such responsibilities anymore. It's just baby steps, but
right.
I just think now, being in California, here in Oakland, what am I gonna, how do I recreate myself?
Okay, let's see if we can, without having to start at ground zero. Let's start with, to what extent, I'm going to tick off a bunch of things, and you tell me which one of them is a good place, starting place for our discussion. It's not what you're necessarily going to end up doing. It was like you're in the shopping mall, and you're looking through the racks of clothing, and you're picking out a few things. So here are a few things that come to mind for me.
Mm-hmm.
At one level, you could simply be a translator, since you're fluent in Spanish, a translator or an interpreter that is live in real time translation. For example, in medical, there's so much in the hospitals, the patients can't, the doctors can't communicate with the patients and so on, and they use medical translators. Another could be to work one on one instead of being leaderly. Where there is so much abstract thinking and so many factors that need to be considered. Do you need to be a one-on-one individual counselor to immigrants who are in, and even if it's a volunteer to take some of the pressure off you for starters? Because I have this intuition. When you're telling me that after the 3 years in a fog, you've gotten better and better over this year, I have this intuition that you need to get back in motion and gain your confidence little by little. And if I had to bet some money, I would bet that by age 55 or 56, you would be more in a more leaderly position if you wanted to be. So if I said right now you needed something to gain your sea legs, to gain some confidence, whether it be to work in the kind of environments you've worked in before, but working either in direct service or even as answering phones just to start off, or in being an interpreter or sign language, an interpreter or a translator. Is there anything in that resonates with you?
So I actually did some interpreting in courts and in the hospitals. But that was just as a fill-in, as a sub. I was like a emergency backup sub, because there weren't that many bilingual people in Vermont, as you can imagine.
Right.
So because I was doing these, working with the governor's office and mayor's offices and police departments, I was just a backup. So I did that. It was fine, that one-on-one work, but I was, I was trying to work on the macro level to resolve problems so I wouldn't have to be putting out so many fires on an individual basis. But I feel like I have a more difficult time with the abstract.
Right, that's why I suggested being concrete for starters.
Right,
that's exactly why I was suggesting
these. I'm leaning towards, retraining myself in something that's very, math or science, where it's very specific. It's not if and or, social studies, social science. It could be any, you can argue any side. But math and science are very straightforward, rigorous, and I think, maybe I just need to start, take a class at Laney or Merritt College and see, just memorize.
So tell me what you like and don't like about the following vision. Since you're saying you want something more cut and dried, basic accounting, while some of it is being automated, certainly a certain amount of basic accounting, accounts receivable, accounts payable, double entry bookkeeping, that is very concrete. There are rules to follow. And again, I have this intuition that this is not where you're going to end up. But I think as a start, what do you like? And I'm not saying you should do this. I'm merely asking you what feels good and bad. You mentioned Lainey. Whenever a client or a caller makes her own suggestion, it usually means her brain is calculated. There's something good about Lainey. So if I said, I want you to take the entry-level course in bookkeeping at Lainey College, how are you? What's feeling good and yucky about that?
So my motivation always in life has been social justice. I've tried to reprogram myself to be more materialistic and try to.
I'm going to interrupt you. No one's needs. No, I'm going to interrupt you. I'm deliberately going
to
interrupt you because, fine, every nonprofit and every government agency uses bookkeepers and accountants.
Yes, right,
so there's no reason why you can't apply those skills in a context that matches your values. So now what do you like and not like about the idea of taking that intro to bookkeeping course and then getting a job at one of the at a nonprofit that reflects your values?
That I won't have direct interaction with people in need.
Okay. So if we said that that would be either one of two things. Either with that basic knowledge, you can help entry-level people with their tax returns. People who are low-income people very often get help in filing their tax returns. Or you could make your volunteer work. You make your living as an accountant. I'm not asking you to work for the American Tobacco Company, but working for an entity for a nonprofit that you believe in. And then in your volunteer work, going back to your immigrant or other kind of causes that you believe in. What feels good and bad about that?
Well, that could make sense. I mean, that I need to have what is, because I was I had my own business. I was wine importing because I was my family makes wine in Spain. I was good at importing wine, and that was easy money, but it wasn't fulfilling. So that's how I ended up volunteering at nonprofits, and then I just ended up working full time doing that. In retrospect, sometimes I think, but I heard you talk about this, it's like sometimes, you know, make your money and then give
some
money to the
causes. I'm going to interrupt you again because I want to take one more call, but I want to give you one more thought. Very often your first job back after a while is for family.
Yeah.
What if we could combine your, you know, your family, obviously, if they're importing wine from Spain, that means that...
No, I was doing that.
Okay.
It's that company's done.
That's done. Okay. But you've got some expertise. I'm just playing here. Just one more idea for you to meditate upon when you get off the phone, which is there are plenty of... Had you thought about doing some simple retail work in Latino neighborhoods, in the areas, you know, where they're... where you're working in the world of wine, maybe in a supermarket and working in the wine and spirits department or any of that as your income-generating thing, or does it feel better to take the course in accounting and bookkeeping at Lainey?
Yeah, it's better to take the course.
Okay.
And because of the injury, I'm, like, hypersensitive to noise.
Okay.
And so being in a retail space, I can't do that.
Barbara Nemko. You got any, you have a thing, anything you would like to add to this before I say goodbye to her and try to take one more call?
No, it's a good thing I'm not a career counselor.
Okay. Then I'll thank you very much for the call. I certainly, both of our hearts are with you. Baby steps, as you use the word baby steps yourself, you know, you sound like you're making big progress from the fog land. And just don't be too hard on yourself when you screw up. You know, so what? Move on. You know, baby step, two steps forward, one step back. Keep going, keep the values, and you'll get who knows how far you'll get.
Thank you so much, because you're very lovable.
Right. Okay, take care.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Okay, right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. How can we help you?
Hi, I just wanted to offer some commentary on the conversation you were having with the African-American engineer earlier in the show.
Okay.
So I used to work as a sourcer for a very large tech firm in Silicon Valley.
Okay.
And, you know, from the top down, they definitely encouraged hiring people underrepresented minorities.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at the, you know, the recruiter level, I think everybody was enthusiastic about doing it. The only thing I would say is when the rubber hit the road, it was very difficult to find highly qualified engineers that were able to meet the technical skill level that this particular company was looking for. So I don't know if it's a lack of effort. I mean, I think it's going to take a lot. As you mentioned, it's got to be in the universities. It's got to become a cultural thing where people from underrepresented minorities look at engineering and look at high-tech jobs as something that, that they want to do en masse.
It's definitely right now, something. Yep. It's definitely, that's why I said, the first thing I said, it's a pipeline issue. You know, as long as, you know, there's no question there is increasing effort for sure to try to encourage the closing of the digital divide and getting more people of color to prepare in starting in elementary school. You'll see these career things, and they show disproportionately pictures of people of color sitting in front of that computer, not just playing basketball. And there are certainly a lot of programs afoot, and so that's why I've tried to be fairly measured in what I said. I think that, as I said, in 5 to 15 years, we will see a very different landscape. But if to just try to do it at the recruiting level, it's too late. So
absolutely
right.
Believe me, I definitely agree with that sentiment,
and that completely comports with my experience. I appreciate that. So thanks very much for the call, Barb. We have a minute or two. Do you have something you want to say at this point? I've been talking, and my listeners have been talking. Is there anything you want to say, or I have something I wanted to run by you? So it's up to you.
Run by me.
Okay. We've got more calls. So let's honor. Let's take one more quick call.
Okay.
All right, I'll just wait a second, and that person will be able to come through. So welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. It is your turn on the air. Make your comment very quick, please.
Very quick. If the caller that you had one caller ago, refer her to vocational rehab or a career counselor.
Very good
vocational
point.
Rehab specifically.
Absolutely.
Great.
Right.
The
California
Department
Voc
of Rehab in the Bay Area.
You're absolutely right. They have a lot of those entry. That's an excellent suggestion. I just love when my listeners contribute. So thank you very much for that. Okay, great. And Barb, so I still have, we have time for this. I want you to react. We did a show a couple of months ago about older workers, which got lots of calls. And there was a number of tips that I wanted to give, but we, again, prioritized the calls. I'm curious what you think of this. We always think about age's disadvantages, but one of the advantages is you've had a long time to accumulate people who like and respect you. And as I said earlier, they're key to getting hired. So older job seekers, especially when there is age having one or two strikes against you, they really need to make a long list of the people who like them and then pitch them. Do you agree with that assertion?
I think it gives you a huge advantage in the job market.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
And again, you can always emphasize your stability, your reliability, your responsibility. Older workers bring a great deal to the table. It's not likely that you're going to come in late because you were out the night before dancing and getting hammered.
And also, it's absurd. Many people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s are in excellent health. And they're perhaps more excited to do the job because they know that they're less in demand than somebody who's 25 and laying that out. And if they're not, you know, the stereotype is they're technologically not up to speed. Well, damn it, get technologically.
Get up to speed, that's right.
You know, we are in an era now where there are such great opportunities, online courses on Coursera, on Udacity, on Udemy, and on LinkedIn Learning, that it becomes very easy, that's a lie, relatively easy to get at least reasonably proficient. Of course, then there were the boot camps. Anyway,
get a private tutor. Get a young person who will come and show you how to use this stuff.
Fair enough. That is Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. I especially welcome the input when you have a suggestion for my call. That's awesome. Community Radio. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, some myths about career. For example, they always say STEM is the answer. Major in STEM. Be a science technology person. Not so clear. They always say network, network, network. Not so clear. We'll talk about that. Until then, this is Marty Nemko reminding you, and reminding, of course, for Barbara Nemko, that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.